1 Kings chapter 4, I think this is an example again of where when Solomon begins his reign, it appears on one level that it's all hunky-dory, but really the seeds of his later apostasy were there right from the beginning. Verse 6, Adoniram was over the men subject to forced labor. There's a lot of emphasis here and in chapter 5 on these forced labor brigades. And it was Solomon's brutal treatment of his people which led to the complaint after his death that he'd whipped his people and abused them. You remember, the people come to his son Rehoboam and say, look, your father abused us. Could you just lighten up the way he's treated us? And he says, yeah, my father indeed whipped you with whips, but I shall whip you with scorpions. And so Solomon's wisdom, which was given him in order to lead this great people of God, I'm afraid he was very selective in how he used it. It all remained as academic, theoretical truth. He writes it all down, the book of Proverbs, it's all very good. But he himself personally lives otherwise, like he says, don't mess with the Gentile woman, with foreign women, my son, be careful. She's going to destroy you if you get involved with Gentile women, but he himself marries hundreds of them, and they turn away his heart from Yahweh. So he doesn't apply it to himself, and he also applies it very selectively, because he is very abusive to people. I mean, he had 700 wives and 300 concubines, plus there must have been a huge number of children. And so verse 7, he has 12 officers over all Israel who provided food for the king and his household. Each man had to make provision for a month in the year. Well, this would have required a huge amount of food and resources to feed them. This is several thousand people that had to be looked after. And he has all these building projects. He's quite obsessed with building. As he says in Ecclesiastes, he went through this thing, this phase about building. And he not only built the temple, he spent even longer building his own house, the house of the forest of Lebanon, and then temples for his wives. And then he says that in Ecclesiastes that he was into all sorts of building projects. And he demanded a huge amount of cedar from Lebanon, hewn stones that had a whole load of slaves basically quarrying them out of mountains and bringing them to Jerusalem, etc. All this involved really an abuse of people, and he was doing this right from the start. So you see the danger of a purely academic approach to God's truth, that yeah, you can get all the theory right, as Solomon appeared to, but you simply don't apply it in the bigger picture, and you don't care for people. So it's all academic. It's all theoretical. And one's got to be careful of this, very careful. When you come from groups, small-time Protestant groups that labour the sort of vital, total importance of correct interpretation of the Bible, of course, we want to interpret God's word, God's voice to us correctly. God has spoken and we want to understand it right. That is right, of course. If I talk to you, I want you to understand me. God speaks, he wants us to get him right. And so, of course, the burden, task of interpretation is going to be there the minute God has spoken. And the fact that God is God and we are but men, of course, this is not going to be an easy task to understand the eternal whose ways are far above our ways. But if that's where it starts and finishes, that my Christian duty is to correctly interpret the Bible, to have wisdom as we see it and have correct knowledge, well, we're forgetting what wisdom means, that the true wisdom is that knowledge applied in practice. That's why when you come to the teaching of Jesus, you know, you can get those Bibles that have got the Lord's words in red letters. And if you just read that, there is very little theology, as I would call it, doctrine perhaps, as some would call it. It's nearly all practical stuff. Now, I am not anti-intellectual, and there is also a spirit of anti-intellectualism in this world that says, oh, so what, don't worry. No, not at all. But on the other hand, look where focusing simply on the academic leads to. And I'm sure we have all observed, as I have done, brethren who are very into the interpretation of Scripture, you must get this right, you must get that right. And yeah, the way they treat people is absolutely stunningly awful. And also, you see people who, for whatever reason, may be illiterate, may be mentally limited, may simply not be the intellectual type by wiring of personality, who maybe don't have a huge amount of knowledge. You ask them, oh, what does this verse mean? What does that verse mean? They might tell you something wrong, or they may just shrug and say, I don't know, mate, I'm sorry, I'm not a great student. And yet, their Christianity in practice is amazing, is marvellous. There's folks like that over the years who've gone to prison and have gone to death for the sake of their basic belief in the gospel. So, as I say, when you see this whole setup here with Solomon demanding all this food, hewn stone, with whole gangs of men working, huge thousands of them, huge divisions of these people, well, no, he's got something wrong, because care for people is lacking. And in the end, that is, I think, the litmus test of whether you're really on the right track in your spiritual path. Well, he sets up this system of officers over Israel who basically raise tax. And you have his taxation system explained here in chapter 4. And he sets up 12 administrative districts, and over each of them there's somebody who's responsible for raising the tax and sending it off to Jerusalem. But you notice that those administrative districts, they don't actually follow strictly the tribes, they are geographical, and Judah is excluded, which of course is his tribe. And when you look at the names of the people who he appoints in each of the administrative areas, you'll see these are all people largely from Judah or somehow related to David's sort of old guard of sort of loyalists to David. You take the ninth group, it's ruled by the son of Hushai, who was David's trusted advisor, who pretty well saved David from Absalom. The eighth group, Solomon's son-in-law, Ahimaaz, is over that. There's a relative of Zadok the priest running the fifth group. Abinadab of the fourth group was again Solomon's son-in-law. So, you know, he's got his guys running the tax system, and it's all going to him in Jerusalem. All very clever. But why does he do that? Because he needs money, he needs resources, he needs wealth for his crazy projects that he talks about in Ecclesiastes 2. And then he says, I gave up with them because they didn't actually give me any pleasure or any ultimate wisdom anyway. Well, 26, Solomon had 40,000 stalls of horses for his chariots and 12,000 horsemen. And then, of course, he needs to have people, verse 28, providing barley and straw for the horses and bringing all this to the place where the horses were, etc. This is a huge amount of resources. And of course, the king of Israel in Deuteronomy is told that he is not to multiply horses. Well, he's got 40,000 stalls of chariot horses. This is huge. And again, you see the point that he was supposed to write out, as the king of Israel, those commandments in Deuteronomy 17. And presumably he did, but yeah, the king of Israel, me, I, must not multiply horses. 40,000 stalls of horses, verse 26, 12,000 horsemen. This is stellar disobedience. How can a guy, on one hand, know God's truth and write the book of Proverbs, and yet when it comes to personal application, do precisely the opposite? Well, I would go so far as to say that I think the very possession of God's truth on an intellectual level will lead you to that kind of hypocrisy unless you humble yourself to personally apply it. This is where I think it's good to pray before we read the scriptures. You know, we should have reading of the Bible as a regular part of our life. And yeah, you do tend to do things at the same time every day. So when you sit down to read, pray. And realize this danger, that possession of knowledge itself, as Paul says, tends to puff up. That is the problem. And yet, of course, we want the knowledge. We want the relationship with God. But don't forget that the Hebraic sense of knowledge is not of academic accumulation of information. It is of relationship. And we live in an age where there has been a knowledge or information explosion, that people in our age have far more information or knowledge stuffed into their little brains than our forefathers ever had. We have a huge amount of knowledge, and the danger is that it puffs up, and it leads us to this position that Solomon was in, to know, and yet the more you know, unless you humble yourself to apply it, the less likely you are to apply it, if it just remains as knowledge. This is where the accumulation of fact, and as I say, it's the danger of an intellectual approach to God, to spirituality. This is where you're going to end up in the Solomon syndrome, unless you're very careful. To have this ability to know, and yet thereby to do otherwise. You see, it's at this very time, verse 32, that he speaks 3,000 proverbs. And these presumably were distilled into the book of Proverbs. And yes, it's all true, so far as it goes. But then he has this huge amount of food brought to him every day, verse 23, 10 head of fat cattle, 20 head of cattle from the pastures, 100 sheep, and also harts, gazelles, roebucks, and fattened fowl. Wait a minute. Harts, gazelles, roebucks, these are unclean animals. It's as if he's like, well, I'm the glorious son of David, I'm the glorious king of Israel, yep, everything tasty on my table. Clean and unclean food, I don't worry about that. So all this wisdom leads him to overlook willfully the most basic principles of God's law. The principle of division between clean and unclean animals was fairly basic to the law of Moses, and as you can see from the account of Noah and the flood, that had been around well before the law of Moses. So he thinks that because he has been given insight and truth and the stuff that's in the book of Proverbs, that thereby freed him up from basic personal obedience. This is why you can get people who they're preaching off a platform, teaching people, having a great teaching ministry, and then, oh, we're all apparently shocked when it turns out this person in their personal life was a terrible hypocrite. Well, it shocks us. I think if you study the book of these books of about Solomon, this historical material about Solomon, and you've thought a bit about it, no, it's not really shocking. It's just the Solomon syndrome, and we've got to learn from that. Sure, we love knowledge. My people perish for lack of knowledge. And yet, we need to desire that, not so that we have bullets to fire at people who are less informed, not so that we might be puffed up, but so that it might enhance our personal, humble walk with the God whom we love.